meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Good afternoon, loyal listeners. This is Loretta Frelick along with her co-host, Mary Hallin Fiorito, and we want to welcome you to Father Anthony Bush's Winds of Change. And it is our blessing today to be co-hosting. And we welcome Mary back to the program after serving so faithfully in the pro-life community, and we're going to hear all about her adventures in just a few minutes. But first, I want to say Happy St. Nicholas Day.
Our did you get anything in your shoe?
Nothing in my shoe, but our Nick was here faithful, board operator, and so we want to say Happy St. Nicholas Feast Day to
Nick. Happy Onomastico. So if you are a cardinal, archbishop in the church, a little fun fact here, on your name day, which in Latin is your onomastico, you get a personal note from the Holy Father. So on the Feast of St. Francis every year, the Holy Father would send a personal note wishing Cardinal George a happy onomastico. And then when Benedict was Pope, his baptismal name was Joseph. So on St. Joseph's Day, the Vatican employees all got the day off for the Holy Father's onomastico. So there's a little Catholic trivia for you. If you're playing the Catholic trivia game around the table at Christmas, you can stump family and friends with that one.
There you go. Nick, did you get a note from the Pope?
Nick? No, he's shaking his head. No.
Okay.
Did you get coal in your shoe, Nick, or did you get anything good? No. Loretta, anything good in your shoe?
Nothing.
No? Okay.
Nothing. So we want to say Happy St. Nicholas, and I had the privilege of attending Catholic Charities St. Nicholas Ball this past weekend, and I wanted to say the spirit is alive and well here in the Chicagoland area. They raised over $2 million for children charities. Yes, it is. Praise God. So we want to just thank all of those generous people. And we also want to remember our friends. Mary, while you were off working on pro-life, we had two guests, friends of mine, Ivory Buston and Sam. And what happened was they talked to us about another event coming up in Chicago, and that event is Revive Chicago, and it is going to be held tomorrow night, and it's going to be held in the coffee shop located on the first floor of the Bridgeport Art Center at 1200 West 35th Street in Chicago, Illinois, and the entrance will be on the Racine side. And there is free parking on the north side of the building opposite 35th Street.
Okay,
but
terrific.
What you know, I'm always crying out that praise changes the atmosphere. And after this past weekend with whatever wilding event was going on
what
in the
on earth,
loop.
Because I was so, for listeners, for those of you who aren't following along at home, I was very much involved in the doing media and giving talks. After the oral arguments the Supreme Court heard in the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health case. So I have been doing sort of nothing since Wednesday. I left my house Wednesday morning at 6 a.m. I didn't get back till after 10. I gave three presentations on Wednesday alone. And then number of follow-up media interviews Thursday. But anyway, long story short is I didn't hear until this morning about this wilding event. I mean,
oh my gosh, unbelievable! It's unbelievable.
Nowhere in this city anymore.
They stabbed a bus driver.
I heard there's video of that.
There is, yeah. and praise God, the bus driver. There's also video of the bus driver walking into the ambulance. So that's good news.
Well, but at least he's not badly injured. But still, I mean, where can you go now and just not feel like?
Here's where you can go, Mary. Tomorrow night, Revive Chicago.
Yeah.
Because when you change the atmosphere, when you start praising, you change the atmosphere. Oh, well. And when the Spirit of the Lord comes down, that atmosphere is changed and, you know, the Lord himself shows up. So this is I really commend my friends Ivory and Sam, and I just thank them both thank Ivory for coming on the program last week. And I just wish them every good gift for this event. And I pray the glory of the Lord will come down.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's,
we need it. Something's got to change in the city. I just don't. What has to happen before people understand how bad it is here? Like, what has to happen?
Well, what was interesting was the mayor was on the news, and the mayor was blaming the parents.
I heard that. And you know what? And I'm not trying to cast blame on anybody, but you do wonder how many of these children, because that's what they were, children, have fathers in the home.
Yep.
How many of them have, mothers who aren't having to work two jobs? And therefore, how many of them are in our ridiculously absurd failing school system where in the Chicago public schools, where now we have bathrooms that are open to all in all the Chicago public schools. Any person can use any bathroom that they feel comfortable in. So we're worried about bathrooms, but 20% of kids graduate from the Chicago public schools reading and writing at grade level.
Right.
But it's more important that we have woke bathrooms. So, Mary, there you go. This is insane.
Mary, a long time ago, I don't know how many years ago, Billy Graham's daughter, Ann Graham, made the statement that in our schools, we asked the Lord to step out.
Right.
And God being a gentleman, he did.
Was happy to oblige us.
And yeah. I think it broke his heart, though, too, Mir.
Yeah.
And, we've talked about this before. Where are they getting the basic foundations? Where are they getting how to treat one another? And it goes back to abortion.
Yep.
You can kill your own child.
Yep.
If he or she... Not it. If
yes.
he or she is inconvenient.
Right.
And so we've told these children for...
That violence solves problems.
Yes.
That's what we've told them.
Get rid of your baby if your baby is inconvenient. I remember, honest to God, talk about, we've all been in the trenches in pro-life, but I remember being on the Oprah Winfrey Show as a guest when it was just the Oprah Show on Channel 7 here in Chicago.
Oh, I didn't realize.
Oh,
I'm in
yes.
the presence of a celebrity here.
Oh, yes, yes.
I never knew.
The guest in the celebrity.
Yes,
yes right, Mir. Anyway, but what happened was Oprah posed the question, and then she let the audience answer it. And then she let these pro-life leaders. I remember Randall Terry, Operation Rescue. He was one of them. And she asked the question, who will be the most affected by pro-life laws changing and Roe v. Wade changing? And I remember God just gave me this answer.
Mm-hmm.
The baby boys and baby girls who are now not killed that will go on to live the purpose and plan that God in heaven created for them from the beginning of all time.
Yeah.
When I think about all the abortions that have occurred in our nation— the things I start thinking of, who did we kill that had the cure for cancer?
Right. Oh, yeah.
Who did we kill that had the right plan for world peace and nuclear disarmament? Who did we kill that was going to be the mother or father to the next Nobel Peace winner? Yeah. I mean, it just becomes mind-boggling that we don't recognize the potential in the child.
Yeah.
In the babies that are slaughtered every day in this nation. And, there also will be a reckoning. This is not just happening and we're going to walk away. Blood stains our nation.
Yeah,
the blood of these innocent unborn stain our nation.
Yep. This can't go unanswered because of, just the severity of it. God, God isn't mocked. And
no way.
We can't. I mean, this is, I know it sounds like I'm struggling for words here, but this is, I don't think people understand that when you have this systemized government-approved killing, what that does, well, right?
Yes.
Spiritually, right, to the rest of it. I mean, and like Mother Teresa used to say this, America, you are rich in everything except the way you care for your unborn, but you are impoverished spiritually.
Amen. Amen.
Yep.
And you know that Mother Teresa, she wasn't just
Mother Teresa.
That Mother Teresa. She wasn't just one holy woman. She was brave and courageous because she said those words
care what anybody,
in forums, like with the Clintons present at prayer breakfast.
Yep.
And so she was able to, because she had the love of God poured out into her, she was able to take this fight to the very courts and the powerful men and women that were causing the stain on our nation and allowing it.
Yeah. Well, it's... I pray our court does the right thing. I don't have any reason to believe, and we'll get into this a little bit later. I don't have any reason to believe that they won't, but we have a chance now to rectify this as a nation.
Yes.
And based upon the kind of the hysteria of the other side after all our arguments, I do think the justices are going to do the right thing. I don't think they have a way to wiggle out of it, to be honest with you. So was there, you said you had two things you wanted to mention.
Those two.
Oh,
St. Nicholas.
St. Nicholas and then,
yes.
Okay, very
but
good.
But Mary,
good.
You know, along what you just talked about, we can take the easy way and just hope. Or we can take the hard way and we can pray and fast that the Supreme Court justices, all of them, not just the ones we think are going to vote our way,
right,
but all of them between now and the day that decision is released in June, have an encounter with the living God, that Jesus would just show up in their dreams, that they would have encounters that would cause them even, and you know, Sotomayor, her comments were absurd.
Yeah, we'll need a full segment just to deal with her alone.
There you go. And you're the girl to do it.
Well,
but really, we must pray. We must pray and fast for our leaders, because it's in Timothy that Timothy tells us, if you want to have peace in your land, you pray for your leaders. So my challenge to everyone is to pray and fast for our leaders, but especially pray and fast for the next 6 months for the Supreme Court justices. They do have an easy decision to make. But
I know that you have obligations in the morning at your parish. Were you able to listen to
I was,
too much of it?
I was. Good. You know, and just for our listeners to know that if they didn't have a chance to go to the event where you were moderating, you can just click on the Supreme Court. And Supreme Court,
Just Google the website.
In fact, I really was surprised it was government and it was easy. So I was a little taken aback. But
Now I was listening. Do you know, is there video available or is it just audio?
I think it's just audio.
Okay. That was my recollection as well.
Yeah.
And
you can order the transcripts now.
Right. Which is fantastic. Because I think we need to take a serious look at especially what Justice Sotomayor was saying, because I do think that is helpful for us to know kind of what the other side says and thinks about
us.
And it's not very nice. And it's just kind of funny after all sort of, you know, everything and all the information we have and all the education we have and all that, you know, that we're still having arguments about stuff that I'm thinking like, okay, don't you people like, does anybody read on your side? Does anybody? I mean, just some of the. Well, no, I'm not. I don't mean that to be unkind.
No, I don't think you do.
Some of the things that were being asserted, were just absolutely absurd. And,
well, but Mary, again, this is what you're looking at: the baby killers and the baby lovers.
Right.
Reasonable, God-fearing versus unreasonable, and really not grounded in reality.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's. It's mind-boggling to me still. I'm sorry. I feel like I'm very much at a loss for words when I'm talking about this, even, you know, almost a week later, and I have talked about it on, you know, radio stations from Washington to St. Louis to everything in between. But it's been, you know, it's been really revealing to be able to see the arguments the other side is using or not using. Some of the – what was very interesting was some of the word language. In fact, the Solicitor General for the United States actually slipped and used the word baby. at one point to the unborn child. Yes. And then a friend of mine who is follows a lot of the gender issues, she pointed out rather amusingly that just for one day, women were actually called women and we were not called birthing people, because that's the new phrase.
Yes,
for those of you not keeping up at home again. That is part of that's the lexicon now. You are not supposed to refer to a pregnant woman as a pregnant woman. She is a birthing person, she or he, because from what I understand, well, I've been told men have babies now, too. And so
really?
She or he is the birthing person. Breastfeeding is now chest feeding. So you have to kind of keep up with the lingo. But it was very interesting to see how many times the word woman was used mm-hmm. by those arguing, both the attorney Reichelman for the abortion clinics and then the Solicitor General for the United States. And, you know, again, this is important to point out. The Biden administration sent its Solicitor General to argue against the Mississippi law. And, you know, why don't we I'll kind of lay out what the Mississippi law was about, and then we can go to break and then come back and discuss it. So the Mississippi Gestational Act was passed probably almost 2 years ago. And what it does is it restricts abortion with some exceptions for life of the mother, et cetera, after 15 weeks gestation. So about 4 months of pregnancy. And that is actually far more liberal than most of Europe has in terms of its abortion laws.
Yes.
Most of Europe, most of the Western world limits abortion electively, so healthy mom, healthy baby, at 12 weeks. Mm-hmm. So you have 3 months to decide. And an abortion after those points is not legal. So in most of Europe. Now, the United States is only one of 7 countries in the world, and the Chief Justice pointed this out. He was corrected by, I think it was the abortion clinic attorney, but I'd have to go back and check the transcript, that no, that's not true. But the Washington Post even has fact-checked this, and the U.S. is one of only 7 countries in the world, including China and North Korea, that permit elective abortions up until the moment of birth. So if you didn't know that, the U.S. people, it does permit legally abortion up until the moment of birth. And that's because our health exception for post-viability abortions is so broad, because health is literally defined in the case that defined health in a context of abortion, Doe versus Bolton, as all factors, physical, psychological, emotional, familial, or the woman's age, relevant to the well-being of the patient. So emotional reasons, reasons like I am depressed or anxious, that is a health reason for a post-viability abortion, or I'm 15 and I'm too young, or I'm 40 and I'm too old. Health reasons for a post-viability abortion. So it really is, the exception swallows the rule because of the Doe case. And so that's why it is absolutely 100% accurate to say that the United States has legal abortion on demand for all 9 months of pregnancy. Now, that doesn't mean that in every state you can find an abortionist who will do them that late. There's all sorts of complications that come in. It takes 2 to 3 days to abort a baby that big, either, you know, by dismemberment or, you know, dead induction of delivery. So a lot of even, you know, your most diehard abortionists don't want to do it because their chance of malpractice, of killing the woman in the process, and all that increases the bigger the baby gets. So it is accurate to say that it is legal for all 9 months. However, the other side points out legality does not equal accessibility. And that's true because, you know, most, the majority of OBGYNs still won't even refer for abortions, much less do them. So, you know, OBGYNs, even if they say they're pro-choice, are walking with their feet. They don't do them.
Right.
And that's why abortions are almost, I think, 90% are done in freestanding, for-profit clinics, because even mainstream medicine and hospitals don't want to be involved in doing abortions.
And what I find also so telling is if you are going to get any kind of health care procedure, you know, you want to go to a cardiologist, you want to go to, you know, a diabetes specialist, you're looking for someone who's board certified.
Correct.
They are doing the up-to-date standards. They have, their practices have been reviewed, peer-reviewed. There's no such thing as board certification in abortion.
Yep. Yep.
I mean, what does that tell you?
Yes.
You are at the hands of someone who doesn't even have a standard peer review.
Yeah. No, it really has already for a long time has really also, you know, just been outside the mainstream of yes. medicine in terms of obstetric and gynecological care.
Yes. And you bleed out in an emergency room.
Yeah.
You don't die in the abortuary.
Correct.
In fact, they want nothing to do with you after they've gotten
their
cash.
They can't get rid of you fast enough.
And they can't get you out the door.
And I'll tell this one short story and then we'll go to our break. But I have a friend, Dr. Bob Lawler, who practices at a hospital in one of Chicago's western suburbs. And he told me this true story. Had a 15-year-old come in. She was septic. At that time, Illinois had a parental notification of abortion law, so her mother knew she had had the abortion, told the doctor she'd had an abortion a couple days later. She was septic because they had left pieces of the baby inside of her. So she was dying. I mean, she was already spiking a fever. So he had to complete the abortion by pulling out the pieces that the abortionist had left behind. And he said he made three separate calls that evening to the abortion clinic, leaving messages saying, "You just put a 15-year-old septic kid on my table. I need to talk to someone there. I need to talk to the doctor who did this. Please return my call." Waited an hour, called again. They completely abandoned the patient. Once they had the money, as you say, she was done, and they left her, you know. And he said, "I had to guess at details that would have been quite helpful, you know, in terms of how I was treating her." But he said they never called him. He said, "To this day, I'm still waiting for my phone call from then." And then, you know, of course, you have the terrible case of Tanya Reeves, the African-American woman whose uterus was perforated during a second trimester abortion at a Chicago Planned Parenthood. If I remember correctly, they waited 7 hours to call 911 because they didn't want anyone to see an ambulance coming. And then by the time they got her to Northwestern, she had already bled out and she died. So, and her son, little son, died with her. So at any rate, well, listeners, we will go now to our first break. And when we come back, Loretta and I will get into with some additional details what happened during the oral arguments in the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health case. This is Mary Fiorito and Loretta Freilich sitting in for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on WSFI FM. Please don't go away.
The cold and snow is just about here. And so, Providence Soup Kitchen at St. Stanislaus Kostka is asking for donations of new or used men's winter coats. You may drop them off Monday through Thursday from 9 a.m. to 12 noon at the Soup Kitchen off the church parking lot. St. Stanislaus Kostka is located 2 blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. Thank you for your generosity.
I'm David Carollo, Winds of Change guest host, and you are listening to the Winds of Change.
Welcome to a St. Nicholas Minute. What is a saint anyway? Although I was imprisoned for 7 years during a terrible persecution of the church under the pagan Roman Emperor Diocletian, I'm one of the first saints honored not because I suffered a bloody martyrdom like St. Peter or St. Paul. I was called a saint because people began to say, "Nicholas loves Jesus so much that you can see a lot of Jesus in him." And that's what a saint is, someone who wants to become more and more like Jesus, who is the light of the world each and every day of our lives. One day when a class of parochial school students were in church, their pastor asked the assembly of children, "What is a saint?" Then a first grade girl pointed up to a stained glass image of a saint saying, "Saints are those people who let the light in." And so as we celebrate the birth of Christ, let your light shine before others that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. Christ is born. Glorify him.
And welcome back and happy St. Nicholas Day. This is Mary Fiorito and Loretta Freilich. We're sitting in today here for Father Anthony on Winds of Change on the new EWTN Catholic Radio Voice for Chicagoland on AM 750 and 88.5 FM WFSI, and we're so proud to be part of the EWTN radio family now, and thank you for listening in. So, as we where you left us, just before the break, we're talking about the oral arguments last week in the Dobbs versus Jackson case, which is a case that came from the state of Mississippi, and Jackson in the is Jackson Women's Health, which is an abortion clinic, the remaining abortion clinic in the state of Mississippi. It involves a Mississippi law that restricts abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy, so that's 4 months. And the Supreme Court heard oral arguments last week. They started at about 9 a.m. Chicago time, and They were slated to go for 1 hour. They went a little more than 2 hours. And in fact, I had, you know, kind of back-to-back speaking engagements that day, and one got bumped up into the other because the court went so long. We started with the Solicitor General, Scott Stewart from Mississippi, who argued the case on behalf of the state. And he was almost, I mean, within minutes of getting into his presentation, interrupted by Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who I am sad to say is the only Hispanic Catholic on the Supreme Court, who credits her academic success and her professional success as a Supreme Court justice and a Latina woman with the Catholic schools she attended. And so it's always very disappointing for me as a Catholic woman to hear another Catholic woman come out and so vehemently argue with an attorney who was trying to stand up on behalf of prenatal human life and laws that protect not only unborn children, but women. And so she immediately kind of right out of the gate, launched into they weren't even really questions. It was almost like she was reading a Planned Parenthood press release. What did you think?
You know, Mary, I think what our listeners need to understand is, and as you know, when you argue before a body like the Supreme Court or the appellate court, you have the argument that you have planned to argue. And you are then up in front of a panel of justices. And what happens is they can interrupt you at any point with a question. It seems sometimes almost like rude. Excuse me, I have another argument to make here.
Right.
But so what you are doing in this arguing process, and just these are just the mechanics. You're putting your finger at the place that you left off when the justice asked you a question, and now you are attempting to answer that question and weave it back into where you're going. So what I found personally was it almost was like she was trying to take him off track his argument.
Exactly. She cut into so well. He had to cede some of his time.
Yes.
So that she could essentially lecture.
Exactly.
And it's almost as if, I'm sorry to say this, because as we're both trained as lawyers, we're both attorneys, so one of the things that's part of your training, especially when you're going to be to get your license and to be admitted to certain bars, is that decorum and manners and treating the other side, even if you would not spit on their body if it was on fire. Like, you are still supposed to treat them with respect.
And civility.
And civility, and you are to be dignified before the court. And I thought, what is she doing? Like, can you imagine one of us, a barrister, speaking to a Supreme Court justice that way? I mean, I just was quite taken aback. It was political grandstanding. And she had a lot of her facts wrong.
I mean,
that's what, even above and beyond her taking his time so that he could not make his arguments. It was already 2-1,
right?
The Solicitor General for the Biden administration,
yep.
and then the attorney for the abortion clinic. And now he had, so it was really almost like 3-1, because now he had Sotomayor basically arguing their points for them.
Yes.
So one of the kind of stranger points, she made was that religions can't agree on when human life begins, and therefore, aren't you really just making a religious argument? I don't know if you remember that particular part of her discourse.
I do.
And
but again, it was, I believe, a divisive tactic that was planned to take him off target, off the argument he was so eloquently making, and throw a monkey wrench into it. And like you said, creating a 3-1 arena.
Mm-hmm. And I think that particular line of questioning, first of all, it is false because
absolutely.
One of the briefs that was submitted was co-written by an attorney from the Thomas More Society and then Dr. Steve Jacobs from Illinois Right to Life, who has a law degree from Northwestern and a PhD from the University of Chicago. And his doctoral dissertation at U of C, which is the number 3 university in the United States, known for producing more Nobel Prize laureates than any other school, including Harvard and Yale and Stanford. Oh, it's true. I mean, just to give context to people, I think sometimes because most of us are from Chicago, we don't realize like we have this academic powerhouse where Bill Gates sends his kids and,
yes.
It really is because we're just so used to it being there in our own backyard. So
right.
I digress slightly. But His doctoral dissertation at U of C focused on the question of when human life begins. He surveyed 6,000 biologists worldwide, and 96% of them, including a good number who identified themselves as, quote, strongly pro-choice, stated they believed that life that is human begins at conception. This is not, A, it's not a religious argument, it's a biological one.
Right.
B, it has been settled definitively.
Yes.
96% of the world's biologists, you know, you look at any OBGYN textbook, you know, Williams Obstetrics, which is the most widely used textbook in the country, any books on neonatology or, you know, fetal development, there's no book that says that life that is human does not begin at conception. In fact, one of them says, I'd have to go back and look at the book. I have this in my notes. But they equate it with a nuclear explosion. So profound are the implications from nothing to something.
Yes.
At the moment the conceptus is conceived. So so why Sotomayor was I think she was just trying to kind of confuse the general public. And this is not a religious question. It is a human rights question. And
exactly.
My friends at Secular Pro-Life did a terrific article for townhall.com. And so for those of you unfamiliar with Secular Pro-Life, they are, as their title suggests, completely secular. The woman who is their president is an atheist and is on the record as saying as such. And she wrote her name's Monica Snyder, and she wrote an excellent article. It was published yesterday. I highly recommend it to you. The title is Dear Justice Sotomayor, If You Want SCOTUS to Stay Out of Religious Debates, Overturn Roe versus Wade. And she walks through all of the arguments. She said, I'm an atheist who opposes abortion. And she said, how disappointed she was that with all the information in all the amicus briefs that Sotomayor had in front of her, that she would have raised that as an issue.
Wow.
Yeah. So at any rate, so the fetal, you know, debate over fetal rights, what you're talking about really is what value we assign to the unborn child. But no one argues with a straight face anymore. In fact, not one of the amicus briefs for the abortion clinic, not one of them, and there were more than 200, not one argued that the fetus was not a human life, because you can't, because it's not. I mean, it is, you know. So, and then, of course, you know, you just look at other areas of the law where the unborn child is recognized as a human being. So 38 states have fetal homicide laws, including 29 states where the law applies even at the earliest stages of pregnancy. And you don't have to know that the person you're killing is pregnant. So if you shoot me, Loretta, because I did a really bad job on the show or something, and I am pregnant and I hadn't told you yet, you'd be charged with what?
Double homicide.
Double homicide, because there are two human lives involved.
And
so
I
there
don't
are
know
two separate counts, one for the child and one for the
exactly.
mom. This is not just, you know, killing of an aggravated charge attached to the murder of the mom. No, there
no.
are two distinct charges.
And
did you ever prosecute a fetal homicide case?
No.
No.
The office wasn't.
We just, I mean, we had the law here,
well,
believe it or not.
I do.
Even in crazy old Illinois.
I do know that, but I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe Kim Fox used to be the statewide director of Planned Parenthood.
Oh, that doesn't surprise me.
So have
we had pregnant mom murder cases where we haven't prosecuted?
Well, there would be pregnant mom murder cases or vehicular homicides. So a woman who is pregnant and is killed in a car crash, the opportunity is there for two counts of vehicular homicide.
Right.
But the process of deciding what charges go forward is determined by the office. And
okay.
So it's at the highest level is determined.
That's really sad.
Well, it is sad. I can tell you that I'm trying to think. Sean Gale's girlfriend, I can't remember her name, but Sean Gale's girlfriend was killed by...
I remember. So Sean Gale, the Chicago Bear,
Sean fans. Sean Gale, but that was up in Lake County again.
Okay.
So Sean Gale, his girlfriend was pregnant. She was killed. The pregnant girlfriend was killed by a woman who imagined herself to be a rival for Sean's attention. She was not. But she killed her, and she killed the the baby. And interestingly enough, even the detectives remark that as this girlfriend was being killed, like, she positioned herself and her hands in a way to protect the baby within her womb. Hmm. And because she was shot by this woman who is now doing time in the penitentiary for two counts of intentional homicide, too.
Yeah.
And including the girlfriend and the baby. But that was several years ago.
Yeah. No, it's.
But you're right. We do have the ability to prosecute that way here in Illinois.
Right. So the law, I mean, I guess even if we're not prosecuting, I guess the fact remains that that the law does recognize them. And, of course, the law also recognizes them in tort law and in inheritance law. I mean, there's all sorts of other contexts outside of abortion where, no, unborn human beings are recognized as human beings, having dignity, you know, the dignity of the law, protecting them, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, some of that, just the absurdities you heard from the other side, who just went into a frenzy because you could tell that they know this is over. And in fact, driving home very late Wednesday from my third talk, I did see that The Atlantic, which is a kind of left of center, but a very well-regarded, well-done publication, The Atlantic Monthly,
correct,
had a headline, The End of Roe. So if I had to speculate, looking at the tea leaves, I know a lot of people were concerned about Justice Kavanaugh. He was the least of my concerns. I'm concerned about Chief Justice Roberts, to be honest with you. And I thought his questions asking for a middle ground. Now, was that part of the kind of theater, if you will, of the whole oral arguments? Because I think, Loretta, you know this, of course, and I know this, but listeners, you may not. Oral arguments very, very rarely influence a justice's decision on how they're going to vote.
Right.
They decided before they walked into that room last Wednesday how they were going to vote, or at least how they were very heavily leaning.
Right.
They use oral arguments to kind of flesh out how they're going to write their own opinions.
Right.
So you saw the very kind of direct lines of questioning to two of them, as a matter of fact, from Justice Thomas, who kept asking, where is this right to abortion, you know, found? Where is it?
Because he said it's not.
It's not. But, you know, according to the response from the abortion clinic attorney, it's everywhere.
Right.
It's just all over the Constitution. Every amendment, you know, it enshrines this right to, you know, selectively kill an unborn child up until the moment of birth. I guess it's just everywhere. And then he also had some very, very good questions.
Mm-hmm.
About bodily autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
And if bodily autonomy, speaking of fetal homicide laws, is one of this great sacrosanct things, why do we have things like, you know, tort law and other criminal law that can charge women with abusing an unborn child while they're pregnant by taking illegal drugs, et cetera, et cetera? So those are still laws that are on the books. And how do you square that? If autonomy is autonomy, we shouldn't care what she's in it. If it's a clump of cells, we shouldn't care if she's drinking a fifth of vodka a day.
Right. Well, you know, too, Mary, I think it's important to remember the history of Roe v. Wade. And what happened initially was this woman wanted to have an abortion in Texas, wasn't allowed. The case went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And both sides argued for abortion and against abortion. And neither one of the two sides was prepared. And the justices sent them home and say, come back better prepared.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was, I think the state of Texas was kind of lulled into who would ever kill a baby. And the other side did their homework and heard the questions that justices were asking and tailored their arguments then to it. So I don't even think on a fair playing field that this was decided appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
Not even, you know, morally incorrect, but here they had, like, you had a double shot at it. And I think that, you know, the justices should have said, I think, you guys aren't ready. This isn't ripe for us to decide.
Right.
You know, send us back another case later. But instead, they gave them like a second bite at the apple.
Right.
And the, you know, the pro-aborts, they took advantage of the opportunity and came back and argued tailored to the questioning they had heard the justices asking, and I guess won the day, but for their side. because there's no way.
Yeah. Well, why don't we go to our next break, and then when we come back, we can finish up our conversation. I want to talk a little bit about viability.
Yes.
And reliance. Those are the other two things that were big parts of the arguments. And so, listeners, please don't go away. We are having a free-flowing and ongoing conversation about the Dobbs versus Jackson oral arguments. This is Mary Fiorito and Loretta Freilich.
Don't kid yourself. We have one of the best pro-life experts in the house.
Oh, you're
Mary,
very sweet. So. You're very sweet to say that. Thank you. I feel like there are so many other people who are eons ahead of me in terms of this. People who actually teach constitutional law, but I have been. You know, the one thing I have to say that morning when I got up, I said to my husband, "I've been working on this issue as a lawyer since I graduated from law school when I was 27. Literally, you know, this has been something
I've
been
working on. And now at 28, you have a handle.
Now at 28, here we are. All I had to do was just be there for 1 year. But I, you know, so almost 25 years of doing nothing but this kind of law and advocacy. And I just can't even believe this day is actually upon us. You know, it was really rather overwhelming. So, all right, listeners, that's a very long way of telling you we're going to go to our break. So please do stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Here's some good news. We are pleased to announce that St. Stanislaus Koska is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in answer to our Blessed Mother's call to open the doors. The Blessed Sacrament will again be exposed all day, every day, except when masses or other services are being held. You are invited to come and pray anytime, day or night. For your safety, we ask that you practice social distancing and wear a mask. Hand sanitizer is available, and St. Stan's has increased cleaning and sanitizing of the church, and a security person will be on site. More information can be found at ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org. St. Stanislaus Koska is located 2 blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway.
We are the students of St. Stanislaus Koska Academy.
Your children can join them for face-to-face classroom instruction. Visit ststanschicago.org to find out how.
And you're listening to the Winds of Change.
I'm Dr. Greg Popchak with More to Life. Family traditions are such an incredible part of a happy, healthy family. Advent is a great time to come together as a family. Incorporating simple traditions like the Advent wreath and Advent calendar and the like can be little ways that your family can bring your faith home and connect with each other. Whatever you do this Advent, make time to be present to each other. Allow God's love to be incarnate in your life in the little ways you love and attend to each other.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito sitting with Loretta Freilich here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 and 88.5 FM WFSI. I'm still getting that into my memory banks because we've just joined the EWTN family recently. So happy to have new listeners, and we're happy to be on board. So Loretta and I have been discussing people, I'm eating a piece of candy during the break. I didn't have breakfast, so you have to bear with me here. We had very good earlier conversation about some of the things leading up to the heart of the oral arguments. And we wanted to focus a little bit now on what the court said were reliance interests. So that was women had come to rely on abortion, especially when their contraception fails them. And so as women, really need to be able to respond to that in a sort of substantive way. And Loretta, what kind of struck you most about that particular line of arguing?
Well, what I found was it was Justice Barrett, Amy Coney Barrett,
right,
who started saying, I think her question was, are you telling me that someone can't make up their mind in like 3 weeks whether or not they want to have an abortion?
Right.
And I think that It was almost as if you are telling me that a law is going to cover a woman's choice opportunities. So it's like there's no law that says you can have an abortion from the beginning until the baby is born.
Right. Yeah, I think where she was going with that was that Justice Blackmun, in the Roe opinion, he was the author of the Roe opinion, grounded this right to abortion in a woman's right not to have to be a parent. So it was grounded in parenthood. So she spent a lot of time talking about safe haven laws.
Right.
And you know a little bit about that.
Oh, the safe haven laws.
Yeah, could you talk about that for a little
sure.
bit?
Sure. Well, you've seen the signs all over the city of Chicago and the county, and they are hands holding a little baby, and you can drop a newborn baby. You could drop that baby off at a hospital, a police station, or a fire station. There are designated places where if you cannot handle this, that you can choose to take your baby to these places where your baby will be safe. There will be treatment that was given, services obtained. And, you know, in a lot of ways, when you see how this law is carried out, I think a lot of ways the city uses it as an extension of, let's find out what's going on with this family. Let's see if we can't reunite a family if they can learn who the mother or the father is. And let's see if we can't get them the services that they need to bring this baby back into their family's life. So if you drop your baby off at a fire station, at a hospital, at a police station, you can't be charged. But if you dump your baby in the garbage, or if you leave your baby like outside of school where you know they'll find them, or in a park in a blanket, you still can be charged. So
right.
The safe haven laws are created to protect the mother and father, if there's a father in the picture, and the baby.
Okay. Well, another part of the argument that was made by the abortion clinic attorney in particular, and I was sort of surprised to hear her go into this in such depth, because the abortion advocacy movement I know in the United States doesn't want abortion to end at viability, and you know, the two clinics that I'm most familiar with here in Illinois both do elective abortions up to 6 months and sometimes even a little bit later. So now all of a sudden we're concerned about viability. And one of the, I think, the best amicus briefs that was filed on behalf of the state of Mississippi was from three doctors. And we are so fortunate we have one of them with us today, one of the authors, Dr. Gracie Christie. Dr. Christie, are you there with us?
I am. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being part of the show today. And I'm so grateful to get someone who is not only so well-versed on the medical aspects of this, but also such a passionate defender of life as an advocate. Can you tell us a little bit about your brief and what were sort of the key points that you were hoping to make to the court?
So my brief, I wrote the brief with two other doctors. I'm a radiologist, and I do fetal radiology as part of my practice. So I evaluate pregnant women and their babies. And the other two doctors were a neonatologist and an OBGYN.
Right. And the neonatologist is actually here from Chicago, a friend of the show here, Dr. Colleen Malloy. So she's
Exactly.
One of our favorites. Yes.
So we were three women doctors, and the point that we made in the brief, in great detail and very well sourced with lots of academic references, is that there have been vast advances in science, in fetal science, in the way we understand the unborn, since 1973 when Roe was decided, and pretty much in three separate areas. Number one, my area, which is imaging. So we know much more about the liveliness and humanity of the fetus because of we're able to image with very advanced ultrasound now, and also MRI. Then also the science of fetal pain. We have a
right.
much better understanding of when fetuses feel pain. And thirdly, what was the third point?
Where do we go? Just about how viability is sort of a moving definition, right?
Exactly. How viability is getting lower and lower. We're down to 21 weeks. In 1973, viability was in the high 20s, maybe
right.
28 or 29
right.
weeks.
And that's if you were at the right hospital. In fact, you know, one of the I did a presentation Wednesday morning right after the arguments and was with a doctor here, a pediatrician who works with children who have neurodevelopmental issues. And she works with a lot of micropremies. And her presentation was really interesting because she talked about the case of Patrick Kennedy, who was the youngest son of Jacqueline and President John F. Kennedy, who died about maybe a couple weeks before his assassination, and talked about how his death at 34 weeks was because he had some, you know, not completely developed lungs, which isn't complete, you know, unusual for male unborn children in particular. And now that you know, babies at 34 weeks, I mean, you know, I had a daughter born in 34 weeks. She didn't even go to the NICU. She just went home with me. So that's how, you know, she compared the cases now to, again, the case of Patrick Kennedy, just as in terms of a reference point. And, you know, I think, you know, I have a nephew born at 22 weeks, 0 days, and, you know, is a very happy and healthy little boy today. So I was quite puzzled by some of Justice Sotomayor's comments on viability. What was your takeaway from some of the things she had to say, other than she didn't read your amicus brief, which was clear?
Well, I think that she betrayed her political instincts.
Okay.
And she betrayed herself. I mean, she's an advocate for unfettered abortion.
Right.
That's what she is.
Yeah.
Because it's one thing to quibble on the science and say, well, it's one thing to say, well, viability has shifted. Why is that? Why is that philosophically important? Let's talk about the philosophical importance of that or the legal importance. But you can't really say with any credibility that the science has held steady since 1973. Science hasn't held steady in any field since 1973.
Right.
Everything
just absurd.
Has advanced. So she was playing politics in a very, she was very, you could also tell from her tone, she was very upset. She was angry. She was peevish. You know,
yes.
I really thought that she made us Latinas look bad.
Well, she was just so uncharitable. And, as you know, we were talking about this at the beginning of the show, and I know you're married to an attorney. You know, part of your training in law school is about being civil and engaging civilly with your opponent. And most judges take that very seriously if they have two attorneys arguing before them who are being impolite or rude or peevish, as you pointed out. It was like she was, you know, spending part of her time reading a Planned Parenthood press release and part of a time trying to, you know, throw the poor Solicitor General from Mississippi right off his game. I mean, the poor man sounded more and more nervous to me as he went on, and who can blame him? And I think he was just trying to sort of hold his own there and not to react emotionally. So you got to give him credit for that. But I was just, you know, astounded with this sort of wave of the hand attitude. Well, we all know that, you know, unborn children don't feel pain, and anybody who thinks that is some kind of radical.
Yeah, she really betrayed her ignorance, and not just her political leanings, but she really betrayed her ignorance, and it was actually sort of sad, the thing that she said about the brain dead patients. Because,
oh, can you reiterate that, please?
Unbelievable.
Yes, Dr. Christie, would you mind just?
Yeah. So the Solicitor General of Mississippi said that unborn babies recoil from pain. He said that.
Right.
They recoil when touched from pain. So they have sensation and they have pain. That was his simple point. And she cut him off. So he might have gone a little further and explained more. But she cut him off and she said that it's well known that brain dead people recoil when you touch their feet. Now, that she's wrong on so many levels. One of the ways that we diagnose brain death in a hospital is by a non-response to pain. So you do a pain test. You create pain in the person, or you try.
Right.
And there's certain ways we do that, like the pressing at the angle of the jaw, for instance, which is very painful. If the patient does not respond, then you put a check mark under brain dead.
Oh, I see.
There's a list of criteria that have to be met before you declare a person brain dead, obviously, before you take them off the respirator. But what brain dead patients do have is they have these very specific spinal reflexes that when you can elicit them in a certain way, that's very specific. It's not like touching their feet. It's a spinal reflex.
Like you said.
So
great,
she got really confused. And
you mean there's science involved?
Or do you think she was being deliberately, you know, untruthful? I mean, I hate to even suggest that, but it just seems to me absurd that she would not think that an unborn child after a certain point in development could not feel pain.
She was being political, is what I think she was being. She was being emotional, and she was her mouth was running away with her. But
her brain ran away with her too, along with the mouth.
You know, we know very well that a baby in the second trimester feels pain, and I'll tell you why. First of all, there's research. So research is being done all the time on neural pain pathways. How does pain get transmitted, right? And so we know a lot more about that than in 1973. So we researchers believe that babies inside the mother might feel pain as early as 12 weeks because of the neural pathways. So when they do those biological sections and they examine the pathways, they think the pathways exist as early as 12 weeks. However, we have another good reason to believe that. When a baby has fetal surgery performed upon them, which is when the baby inside the mother is brought out of the mother, operated on and put back.
Right.
Fetal surgery is never done without anesthesia because the baby reacts to painful stimuli. So if the baby reacts outside the mom, connected to the mom with the umbilical cord at 23 weeks, and they have to anesthetize the baby, then how do we also have a country in which you can rip a baby apart?
Right.
Piece by piece.
Without anesthesia.
I mean, you wouldn't do that to your neighbor's yappy puppy who's driving you crazy.
You know, that's an interesting point, Gracie, because I was on a radio show on the East Coast with someone who, and I didn't realize this, but the show host is a retired veterinarian. And he was telling me, he said, I can't, you know, when they're doing these late-term abortions, they often do a procedure where they inject something that stops the baby's heart. You know, they go through the pleural cavity, et cetera, with a long needle into the baby's heart to stop it. They do that with some of the later term abortions. He said, do you know if I did that to an animal that was not either comatose or I had anesthetized, I would lose my license? Mm-hmm. He said, I literally could not do that to a pregnant cow, to a horse, anything like that without using anesthesia or making sure that pain couldn't be felt by the animal. And then, you know, just secondly, in terms of fetal surgery, one of my neighbors is a pediatric anesthesiologist, and she has helped at surgeries as early as 18 weeks to correct spina bifida. And she said, you know, listen, my team is there just for the baby. The mom has her own anesthesia team, and my team is all I am focused on for that surgery is that baby to make sure that, and some on the pro-abortion side will say, oh, we're just trying to make sure the mother doesn't have any kind of stimuli reaction, or you would know, obviously, the medical words for it. But she said, that's not the case. I am there to monitor the baby's pain, their blood pressure, you know, other grimaces, you know, other ways in which we as doctors can tell that our patient is in pain.
Yeah, when, it's part of it is this ignorance about pain, like how people measure pain. Pain is not measured simply by saying, oh, this hurts. People who can't express themselves feel pain. And the way you know is their heart rate goes up, they start to breathe more deeply, they grimace, their eyelids flutter. I mean, there's ways that we clench our hands when we feel pain. So fetal anesthesiologists know this.
Right.
And also, when babies are born at 21 or 22 weeks, at the same age as which they can be aborted legally in every state in the United States, when those babies are born and then they're in the ICU, there is supreme care taken to keep them free of pain and any kind of traumatic experience, which could be as simple as bright lights. I mean, they keep the lights down around them. They keep the noise down.
Yeah, my nephew had quite a bit of fentanyl. And I remember, like, my mother-in-law calling me saying, is this okay for a baby to have this much fentanyl? She was actually concerned because they had to give him because he was so tiny, you know, 22 weeks when he was first born.
Wow. Yeah. So much care is taken for these babies to keep them from being traumatized with painful stimuli at 21 weeks, at 22 weeks, at 23 weeks, that to even, you know, for poor Justice, I feel a little sorry for her, for poor Justice Sotomayor to you know, act as though it's some kind of fantasy. Well, she also made me mad because she said that doctors like me are fringe.
Oh, wasn't that so insulting and unprofessional of her to do that? Well, as a radiologist, can you talk about just some of the advances that in the couple minutes we have left here, Doctor, in ultrasound technology, what are some of the things that you've really seen even over your career? If you can tell us super quickly, that music means we're wrapping up here.
Well, the biggest advancement in fetal ultrasound in the last few years has been 3D and 4D ultrasound, which are very beautiful ways of seeing a fetus.
And you included that in your brief, and it's too bad it appears Justice Sotomayor didn't read it, much less look at it. So, well, Dr. Gracie Christie, we know how busy you are, and God bless you and your good work and all that you do for the cause of life. We're so grateful that you could join us on such short notice today.
Oh, thank you. It was an honor.
All right. God bless you. All right, listeners, that has been our show for today. Again, as usual, it flew by. Please do join us next Monday, where we'll have a whole new lineup of interesting guests and topics to discuss.
Your assignment is to pray that each justice has an encounter with the living God and that they choose a life for America.
Again, I can't think of any better way to end than on that call for prayer. This has been Mary Fiorito and Loretta Frelick sitting in for Father Anthony here on Listener Supported Winds of Change. Have a great week. God bless you.
Time to be stirred. The time.